Hello everyone and welcome to the Global Health Charity Show, a brand new UK health radio show that will be diving into a whole host of different health topics presented by a network of charities and organisations working in global health. These include the George Institute, Compassion UK, Malarian Consortium, Action Against Hunger and Unlimit Health. Join us for a 15-minute long show on the last day of every month, where a different charity will host a deep dive on various global health topics and raise awareness of issues we're facing in health today. My name is Melissa Jones, and I will be your host for this episode featuring Action for Global Health. I am the Digital Communications and Campaigns Officer for Action for Global Health, and of course, a passionate healthcare advocate. Action for Global Health are a network of over 50 plus UK-based organisations working collaboratively to ensure UK stakeholders renew their leadership and commitment to global health. We provide access to key decision makers, joint advocacy and campaigning opportunities, and the chance to participate in an active global health community. To aid our advocacy work, we run a national campaign called Healthy Futures, which was created as a result of the belief that no matter who we are or where we live, we all deserve the right to good health. Whether it's having access to essential healthcare, seeing a doctor when you have concerns, or getting your COVID-19 vaccine, everyone has the fundamental human right to a healthy future. But sadly, for half the world's population who lack access to essential health services, this is not a reality. Every year, 100 million people are pushed into extreme poverty due to healthcare costs, with the COVID-19 pandemic worsening inequalities between those who have access to healthcare and those who don't. The impacts of climate change, such as rising sea levels, droughts and heat waves, also continues to harm people's health, as we see the devastating effects of our changing climate on communities all over the world. But of course, it doesn't have to be this way. Through Healthy Futures, we hope to unite campaigners to call on the UK government to achieve our goal of health for all. You can join our movement and be part of making Healthy Futures for All a reality by visiting healthyfutures.uk and signing up to our mailing list to be kept up to date on Healthy Futures news and future campaign action. We would love to have you on board. And now, on with the show. So on today's show, episode one of the Global Health Charity Show, we are excited to be marking International Women's Day by speaking to three incredible women who are advocating for women's health and rights within the global health space in a range of different fields. First up, we have Katie Husselby, who is the Network Manager of Action for Global Health, talking to us about what global health is and the importance of advocating for universal health coverage, as well as how this affects us here in the UK. We then have Tora Abrahams, who started her advocacy work in human rights law before moving into the voluntary health sector, working in women's health and services. She previously worked for Freedom for Girls, a charity campaigning for the end of period poverty, and now works with the Black Women's Reproductive Health Project, which she's going to tell us a little bit more about. And lastly, we have Dr. Karina Hockham, who is a postdoctoral research associate in epidemiology in the Global Women's Health Programme at the George Institute and Imperial College London. She'll be talking to us about her work using large population data to examine sex and gender-based differences in risk factors for various diseases, including chronic kidney disease and their associated health outcomes. We're so excited for you to join us for this very first episode focusing on women's health to mark International Women's Day. And enjoy the interviews with these amazing women who are game changers in the future of women's health. So first up on the show, I'm really excited to introduce you all to our network manager here at Action for Global Health, Katie Husselby. Welcome.
Hi, Mel. Thank you for having me on the show.
Thank you so much for coming on. I just thought it'd be fantastic to give the whole show a little bit more context in terms of how women's health is impacted by general global health and talk a little bit more about some of the work that we do and what you do and talk to us a little bit more about global health.
Thank you, Mel. Really excited to be here today. Yeah, as you mentioned at the start, I'm the network manager for Action for Global Health. We're a network of more than 50 organisations working together towards a world where everyone has access to the quality healthcare they need without being forced into financial hardship. As a network, we really believe that the UK government can play a really positive role and contribute towards this vision. And so we advocate and we campaign together to secure political actions and commitments in the UK to improve health around the world. I've now been working with Action for Global Health for the past 4 years. A little bit about how I came into this space. I was always really interested in a career in health and in healthcare, but I wasn't very good with surgery and I didn't want to work in a kind of clinical role or a sort of healthcare front-facing role. But when I was at university, I became involved in sort of student activism, particularly around international development, and worked with an organization focused on connecting students at all different universities around the world to create friendships, create relationships, collaborate together on projects and share learning. And also became increasingly interested in health inequalities, initially through the lens of menstrual health, how different people were able or not able to access menstrual health products, how they were able to manage their periods, and the subsequent impact that that had on their lives and well-being. And so I decided to pursue a career in health advocacy, and particularly looking at how we can influence governments, influence decision makers, to make the right decisions that will impact positively on health for people all around the world.
Can you just tell us a little bit more about what global health actually is and what is universal health coverage?
Absolutely. So global health, put simply, is health globally. What is the health that people experience and the access to healthcare that they have globally? And for us, this really means universal health coverage. That's the issue that we really care about and the progress that we want to see globally. Universal health coverage, it sounds a little bit complicated as a term, but what it means is that everyone has access to the full range of different health services that they might need in their lifetime, when and wherever they need them. So that might be things like health promotion, health prevention, treatment for a particular disease, might be rehabilitation after being unwell, or it might be palliative care. And it's across your entire life, across the full life course, what might be all of those health services that you might need to have access to. And crucially, being able to access those health services without experiencing financial hardship as a result of doing so. Protecting people from the financial consequences of paying for health services is a really important part of this. We don't want to see people paying out of pocket for essential health services. And we see in some instances people being pushed into poverty, but as a result of unexpected illness requiring them to use their life savings or to sell assets or to go into debt, which can have a really devastating impact on people and their families. And maybe to bring it, you know, very personally to us in the UK, the National Health Service, the NHS, which we all know and love, established after the Second World War, that was the first universal health coverage system created in the world. So universal health coverage and the National Health Service are sort of synonymous to us in the UK.
This is an element of health where, you know, when we talk about the NHS in our country, that we take for granted the fact that, you know, we've had the NHS for such a long time and how it's been able to adapt, especially over COVID. And, you know, it might be difficult for some people to think about how could that not be applied in other areas of the world, because like it's something that we just know that we have and perhaps some would take for granted, whereas others, you know, could, like you said, lose assets and become homeless because of having to pay for treatment out of pocket and not having access to that healthcare. Why is it so important that everyone has access to healthcare in terms of, like, how does this affect the UK public? Obviously, we have our NHS here in the UK, but in terms of the impact of that on the UK public, why is it so important to have that throughout the world and how that affects the UK?
As you were saying just then, Mel, having access to healthcare is a universal human right, but it isn't experienced universally. So all over the world and here in the UK, people are denied this right to healthcare or experience barriers and difficulties in accessing healthcare because of approaches that fail to prioritise people's health and well-being. And you mentioned COVID-19 is a really important example. It showed everyone very clearly how different political, social, economic determinants led to inequalities in how different people and different populations experienced the pandemic. So the burden of disease was felt mostly by often marginalized populations, older people, people with disabilities, informal workers, Black, Asian and minority ethnic communities experienced higher levels of inequality in terms of access to healthcare in the context of the pandemic. But the pandemic also taught us in a very difficult way that nothing is more important than good health. And good health is the foundation for every aspect of human well-being. It's really closely linked to all of the other aspects of our lives. So we saw during the pandemic, people being prevented from doing their job, from going to work. We saw global school closures, people being prevented from continuing with their education. And we saw increasing gender inequality. Yeah. So many aspects of life were impacted by the pandemic. And so we've now seen and experienced everywhere in a very real sense why access to healthcare, why good health is so important and so central to everybody's lives. Prioritising health in a post-COVID sort of world should be an absolute priority for everyone, for politicians, for decision makers in particular, but for all of us to come together and prioritise health. This is a real moment. I think this is a real opportunity. Everyone is aware, everyone is interested following the COVID-19 pandemic in health. And so we need to translate that into strengthening our health systems and ensuring that everybody, no matter who they are, no matter where they live, is able to access health services when they need to. And we've also seen a growing number of humanitarian crises in recent years. So we saw the floods in Pakistan, very recently the devastating earthquake in Turkey. So, and there we've seen particularly how having emergency healthcare responses in place is so critical. So for a whole host and range of reasons, but I think particularly in light of COVID, everyone has seen why it's so important to have access to healthcare, why we should all care about it as well.
They said that lessons must be learned. And, you know, we talk a lot about the fact that we need to be making sure that these times are not forgotten, that they're able to kind of use those learnings to be able to propel ourselves into better healthcare for all and in places where they don't have access to it. Really, really important to keep that fresh in people's minds. How does the UK government support global health?
So the UK supports global health through its international development work, sometimes commonly sort of known as UK aid, which is managed and distributed mostly by a government department called the Foreign, Commonwealth and Development Office. But there are other departments that are also involved, like the Department for Health and Social Care, for example. In last year, in 2022, the UK launched a new international development strategy, which established global health and improving global health as one of their three kind of key pillars of that strategy. The UK have also announced other sort of key commitments around strengthening health systems globally and ending the preventable deaths of mothers, newborns and children around the world. However, and slightly disappointingly, the UK has fallen short of developing a full global health strategy or plan in recent years. It hasn't had a global health plan in place since 2015. So this is something that we've been calling for, is a full plan, a full strategy to outline how it will deliver on those commitments that it's announced in recent years.
Why isn't there a plan? Like, particularly there seems to be a lack in planning, but also like a formal plan with action points. But then to go and cut UK aid nearly 2 years ago, like, what effects have these decisions had on countries overseas receiving support?
In terms of the strategy, having a plan in place would enable everyone to be able to see very clearly this is what the UK is seeking to do and this is how it will work with its partner governments all around the world and with all different stakeholders across civil society and people with lived experience of the health issues that they're working on, to all be a part of a kind of joined up process and plan for how they work on global health. As you mentioned, the cuts that we've seen to the UK aid budget have impacted how the UK is able to work on global health and the extent to which it's able to work on global health, which I imagine is one of the barriers and challenges in terms of them developing a strategy. So we're now facing the third cut to the UK aid budget in 2 years. The government announced last November the UK aid budget will now be slashed by another 1.7 billion in less than 6 months. These cuts have had really devastating impacts on organisations, on people, on projects, particularly based in low and middle income countries. We've seen some projects cut altogether, basically overnight, including projects dealing with malaria prevention and treatment and palliative care, sexual and reproductive health, and contributions to the health workforce, training and training of health workers, We've also seen the removal of support for mental health services and also reduced research on global health threats as an area that's sort of seen cuts as well. So really across the board of all different types of health services, we've seen really devastating impacts. And that's why it's so important that not only does the UK put in place a global health plan, a global health strategy, but that it resources that strategy as well by restoring the UK aid budget to the 0.7% target. So this is a target that the UK government had originally had in place of how the percentage of GNI that they wanted to spend each year on international development projects. So we'd like to see that 0.7% budget restored as soon as possible.
Well, regarding this issue, like, why do you think it is so important that the UK public are aware of issues around global health?
I guess at a really basic level, because global health is something that impacts all of us. So we saw in the COVID-19 pandemic that nobody is safe until everyone is safe. And so this is something that impacts all of us, it's something that we should all care about. COVID really brought a lot of that to light and sort of raised people's awareness on these issues. And also because we have an opportunity to do better. You mentioned earlier that it's so important that we take on board the lessons learned from the pandemic and do better in the future. And we have an opportunity right now to build and repair our health systems to work for everyone. We've also got political attention on this issue. Political leaders understand in light of COVID or recognise that health is important. And so we have an opportunity to utilise that attention to make sustainable progress. We need to make sure that every country has well-trained health workers and they have access to quality medicines and other health equipment, adequate and sustainable financing. This is really the time right now to reimagine our health systems to be resilient, fair, and most importantly, equitable, so everyone is able to access the health services they need. We need to listen and elevate and champion those who are most marginalised in society. We need to ensure that we're constantly making health issues political issues, that they're getting the attention they deserve. And particularly in the face of climate change, which we spoke about earlier, the impacts that we'll be seeing on health as a result of climate change, we really need to make this progress now. We need to ensure that we have sustained solidarity and that the UK is working shoulder to shoulder with other countries to improve how the world shares learning, shares guidance, shares resources on health in the future as well.
And you think this is the best way in terms of advocating best for global health?
I think we're most powerful when we come together. I spoke earlier about what I feel is the importance of networks, and campaigning is a really important part of that. It brings people together from across all different walks of life, whether you're a health worker, whether you're a student activist, whether, you know, wherever you come from, as we said earlier, everyone cares about health. And so everyone has a role to play in ensuring that governments are held to account to improve health for all.
So, Katie, to close, what is next in our fight for universal health coverage?
So we'll be keeping going with our advocacy work at Action for Global Health, in particular, putting a spotlight on health inequalities and ensuring that the UK government is playing its part, that it's making positive actions, positive commitments to improve global health. And we'll continue to raise awareness, to work with our fantastic campaigners through our Healthy Futures movement to ensure that we're holding governments to account, and particularly also that we'll be continuing to focus on the impacts of climate change on health and ensuring that that's a really important part of government discussions around climate change as well.
It's going to be a busy year, but it's going to be a fantastic challenge and it's going to be really rewarding, and the impact is going to be felt so long term. Thank you so much for coming to explain a little bit more about global health and some of the work that we do. Hopefully we've got some activists listening that'll help in our fight for a universal health coverage. But if you would like more information, please visit www.actionforglobalhealth.org.uk to find out a little bit more about us and a little bit more about our advocacy work, and also how you can get involved at our campaign website, healthyfutures.uk. Thank you so much, Katie.
Thank you, Mel.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
So next up on the show, we have Tora Abrahams, a wonderful guest who has worked extensively in women's health and is here to talk to us today about the discrimination and some of the issues that women are having in reproductive health and health generally. So welcome, Tora.
Hi, nice to be here. Thank you for having me, Mel.
Hello, thank you so much for being here. We're so excited to have you on our show. Introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about more of the work that you do. And just tell us a bit about that.
I am a Northerner. I'm from Manchester, and I previously worked in human rights law. So I worked for a solicitor's firm that specialised in supporting people who were in prison with access to services and access to justice and so on. And one of the things that I first recognised when I was doing that work was within the system, there was a lot of design that was done by men and for men's needs, but failing women. And one of the first civil claims that I ran was on behalf of a female client who was quite old. She was in her late 40s. And I say that in the menstrual health world of being old. I don't think late 40s is old, just to clarify. She refused a strip search because she was menstruating. And we were successful in that claim. But as a result, she experienced a lot of difficulties going through the prison service. So along with a number of other female clients, I started to recognise that a lot of the work that was happening and the services and the regime that was provided in that particular sector in the prison estate was very much negating women's needs and the issues that women experience that are so very different to men. So from there, I ended up leaving the legal aid sector and I moved into the voluntary sector. And one of the first organisations I worked for, and actually every single organisation bar a couple that I've worked for since about 2016 in the voluntary sector have been women's organisations that provide gender-specific services. I also volunteered for a charity that is based in Leeds, and they work on addressing period poverty, and they're called Freedom for Girls, and they're one of the first charities that campaigned for a lot of the impacts of what period poverty does, particularly for young women and girls and people who menstruate, but also period poverty across a woman's general reproductive menstrual health lifespan. And the work I found so fascinating because, like happened when we were campaigning at the time, you would never think that in one of the biggest economies in the world and the country that we have and how developed we are in terms of our technological advances and the wealth of a lot of people here and so on, that people would still be suffering from ultimately the blanket definition of not being able to afford period products, which is period poverty.
It's always fascinating to hear people's stories of how they think that they're going down one path and then they end up kind of getting caught up in those issues, becoming crusaders for the cause and just thinking this is actually something really meaningful that is very close to my heart that I want to pursue.
Absolutely. And I think what is really interesting from me personally going through that journey, so to speak, was that I had issues with my periods for a really long time. So, I mean, I went into human rights law because I am proudly a woman of mixed race South African heritage. So my family immigrated here because of the apartheid regime. So I've always wanted to kind of work on behalf of and the advocacy of vulnerable and marginalised communities. But then when I was in the women's sector, I still had that kind of emphasis of looking at, you know, how can we reduce inequality and racial injustice and so on. But the women's health stuff, I always put my own personal experience of that sort of on the side burner of all the other stuff that was going on in my life. And then when Freedom for Girls came along and I was doing the campaigning around what is period poverty generally, oh, actually, so much of this has affected me because when you break down the definition, there's a really good report done by Plan International, again, around the same time, 2017, that created the definition, which was not just the lack of access to products, but it was lack of education, of understanding our menstrual health cycles. And thirdly, like the stigmas and taboos around periods. And like I said, my journey was that when I came to contraceptive pill at 21, I didn't have periods for 18 months. Then I took me 12 years to get diagnosed with endometriosis, and I was really unwell for a large part of my 20s because I was having so many issues around my hormones, my reproductive health, having endometriosis. So it's really interesting how they've gone hand in hand, but almost like my personal struggle was secondary to the actual activism that I was doing, that I fell into. And then it just kind of tied together. And that's why I feel more passionately about it as well now, because it bothers me that so many women do go through that kind of unawareness because of the issues related to stigmatizing periods. Everyone's experience is different, but because there is the shame and the, you know, all behind closed doors kind of thing, women hiding tampons up their sleeve to go to the toilet, we're not able to have open conversations as easily as we should about not just the natural experience, but also a very serious, in some cases, health-related experience. Mm. Unless we are able to have better education of it, but also the reduction in the stigmas around it at the same time, it's very unlikely that we'll be able to see much significant difference to how it is affecting women's quality of life.
Would you be able to go into a bit more detail about what period poverty is and why we experience this, obviously worldwide, but also like here in the UK, where a lot of people don't know about it?
So my colleague Tina works in public health for the local authority in Leeds. She was doing a lot of work with food banks, and she was recognising that, I think the Trussell Trust posted a report, about 450,000 people were accessing food banks within West Yorkshire. It's roughly that amount in sort of the just before the pandemic period. Mm. And she was doing, she's a very community development driven activist. So she's on the ground all the time and having conversations with people. And the conversations were, has anyone got any ideas of what to use for period products? Because I can't afford pads, I can't afford tampons, I definitely can't afford the reusable products. People are accessing food banks to be able to afford food.
Yeah.
They're also not going to be able to afford period products, as Plan International defined after their bouts of research across the country. So it was the definition, which was lack of education, lack of affordability or accessibility of products, and also the stigmas and taboos. And they also found that 1 in 10 young women and girls were unable to afford these products. And they surveyed a number, but they were aged between 14 to 21. So you're talking about people in lower to higher education. What we've seen is inequality rise so drastically, mm-hmm. right, in the last kind of 4 years. And then you take the 10 years before that with austerity, and in the last 4 years with the pandemic and the cost of living crisis, it is getting so much worse. And I think it's really important as well, I want to be able to say that the cost of living crisis absolutely impacts everybody. We don't, this isn't just a gender-based issue, yeah. But I think from with the hat that I'm wearing, it's really important to talk about how vastly it affects women, because our experience of life is so different and periods are a massive part of our life. We shouldn't be discriminated for that. The cost of living, not just because of lack of affordability, but because inequality is so massively fast now, it's really exasperated things.
How do you think these issues translate in lower middle income countries?
I have colleagues in South America, and I have a lot of colleagues in East Africa and the south of Africa. We see the disparities because patriarchy exists everywhere and inequality exists wherever patriarchy does. But something that I noticed from the pandemic and moving into the cost of living crisis was there was a lot of data coming, like I said, from my colleagues in East Africa, particularly in Uganda and Kenya, that were talking about the significant rise in teenage pregnancies. And with that, the exploitation of young women, really, taking advantage of young women, human trafficking extremely on the rise at the moment as well.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Why do you think that there is such a stigma?
I do believe that the attitudes and beliefs and where we place value on women as a result of patriarchy are a really big part of why the stigmas and taboos come about. But I don't know if the stigma is also partly to do with a complete lack of understanding. I have got incredible colleagues, male colleagues and female colleagues in Uganda, particularly in the west and the east of Uganda. And they talk about periods with boys and girls. It opens your eyes to appreciate the normalization of something natural. There isn't this need to create a stigma because of the unawareness. Like wherever there is positive grassroots activism of people who want things to change, the stigmas will slowly trickle away. And I'm definitely seeing that in areas where I work in Uganda for sure.
How do you think COVID-19 has affected reproductive health services in lower middle income countries, but also generally just globally, how COVID has had an effect on that?
What we are definitely seeing in this country I can speak on, and in areas in East Africa where I practiced, is women aren't getting seen effectively, their issues aren't being diagnosed effectively. There is so much conversation at the moment around, especially in East Africa communities, cervical health screening, effective cervical health screening. It's not a priority. And because of the impacts of how those healthcare systems have been able to manage COVID, it means that, again, general other health issues that are already down the list are completely unable to be actioned and prioritised. I think global leaders need to take a much bigger look at how they're educating people on their own individual health awareness, but also why women's needs aren't being prioritised. I think this needs to be top of the agenda.
I just wanted to touch on the BMJ article that you wrote on menstrual healthcare and a bit more about the Black Women's Reproductive Health Project. Would you mind talking a little bit more about your involvement with the report and a bit more about your work as a result?
Of course. This is something we're really, really proud of. I want to start off just by thanking my colleagues Danielle and Holly, who spearheaded the BMJ article, and they were part of the team we founded the project in 2020. So it was a really important time for us because we were behind closed doors and there was a lot of distribution of products that we were doing. That's one big thing that Freedom for Girls does. So for people who can't access products or afford them themselves, we're running around the country trying to give them out, basically, predominantly in West Yorkshire. And big community that we support in West Yorkshire, very big African Caribbean community. And we're working with Nigerian Centre, the Ghanaian Centre and Swahili Community Centre. And with that big spark that was reignited into the Black Lives Matter movement as a result of George Floyd's murder, we kind of sat back. We had a team of volunteers that were supporting us, different things, but again, behind laptops, because that's what the pandemic did to us. And we just thought, like, if we're all acknowledging and we're agreeing that systemic racism really does exist in all areas and sectors, what is it that, how is it transpiring, should I say, in the mental health world? And how is it affecting directly the communities that we serve in West Yorkshire, the ones I've mentioned, but also we practice in East Africa and Kenya, and I have some colleagues in Tanzania and South Africa. We wanted to do something tangible that was going to reduce the inequalities and the disparities in outcomes for Black women and Black mixed women within this space. We had a lot of data already, but it predominantly was two things. It came from America, and it also was around maternal health and pregnancy. We've touched on that already and why that has some attention, quite rightly. The data that the maternal health work was looking at showed that Black women experienced 5 times more fatal issues, either themselves or for their children, in pregnancy or in labour or further postpartum, if you're Black and if you're of another racial ethnicity. And so we thought, well, then if a woman's maternal health is so massively impacted by her menstrual health, then there must be something going on further down the line before they get to the point of fertility. So we did 3 things. Initially, looked at a research report that able to survey just over 165 women and people with female reproductive systems. And we collected some incredible data. And ultimately, it found 3 main things, which we already knew, which was everything we've said about period poverty, the lack of education, the stigmas around menstrual health, but then simultaneously the issues that race had to play in that space too. And it was really interesting because pain was something that really came up, and an awareness of pain, an understanding of our pain, what is normal pain, and how being from a Black, an African or Caribbean family or culture, how does that also impact conversations that we have around pain? But then how do you manage those as well? And then with the other findings, we saw that there was a lot of mistrust in a lot of healthcare providers, or lack of confidence, should I say. And there was a big disconnect between knowing when to seek healthcare support for serious things. We were really proud of that research piece that was put into a report that was launched in August last year. And then with that, we fed into the BMJ article where we made some recommendations as well. And again, it feeds into proper education holistically, though, so that it's not just individual women feeling like, oh, I know what's going on in my body and I feel confident to advocate for myself in a healthcare setting. It's also for healthcare providers to have a better awareness of what exists as conscious or unconscious biases in their field. We managed to also provide tangible support, again, one of the BMJ recommendations, in peer support groups. So because of, and I spoke about it from my experience, it's really arduous trying to get a healthcare provider to take your issue seriously, but also not all of the options in terms of action are something that you want to proceed with or that you trust or that you feel comfortable with and so on. So having those conversations and shared experiences and the emotional empowerment support that women are so good at providing to each other That's what we do in the peer support group. And the third thing is to work with healthcare providers so that they understand how to do something about the research that we've found. The feedback that we've had so far has been incredible. The confidence and the advocacy that comes collectively for a wider community as part of that is so important.
It must have been just such a fantastic experience, like a really fulfilling experience to be able to do that and, you know, help so many people and give them a safe space as well.
Completely. And the idea of feeling safe to do that is something that women, I don't think we're provided the opportunity to feel emotionally and physically safe as often as we should. Also, the confidence that comes out of them is, I think, again, fundamental to seeing change in this area.
Absolutely. Off the back of this, like, what advocacy projects have you got coming up?
Follow us on social media. We're just developing our LinkedIn page now, Black Women's Reproductive Health Project, and we sit under the African POP Project, who are Manchester based. Yep. We are on Instagram as well. The advocacy pieces will come in drip stages. So the next one will be hopefully a resource that women can take away from them, and it will be inclusive and accessible. So if you don't have a smartphone, you can have a paper copy. We hope to get it in a number of languages, but it will be helping you feel empowered and confident to advocate for yourself in a healthcare setting. We hope to do something massive in a partnership with other grassroots activists for World Menstrual Health Day, which is the end of May. And generally, I think we won't disappear from this space in the future or anytime soon, because the momentum behind what we're doing now is just fantastic. We just need a lot more support and the physical things like funding and resources to make a bigger difference. The Instagram handle, thank you, is quite long. It's Black Women's Repro Health on Instagram.
Cora, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure to speak to you. And thank you so much for answering so many questions we've had regarding women's reproductive health and just generally women's health. Just huge, huge thanks.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Radio. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
And next up on the show, we have a very, very special guest. We have Karina Hockham, who is the Postdoctoral Research Associate in Epidemiology in the Global Women's Health Programme at the George in Imperial College London. Welcome, Karina.
Hi there. Hi. Nice. Thank you for having me.
No, thank you so much for coming on. We're so excited to have you. If you'd like to just tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into this field of work, we'd love to hear more about you.
Sure, thank you. So I'm a non-communicable disease epidemiologist, and my main area of work focuses on sex and gender research in kidney disease specifically, and a little bit in cardiovascular disease as well. What sex and gender research means is essentially understanding how women and men are differentially impacted by these conditions. I also have a second hat, which is as programme manager of the UK arm of the Women's Health Programme at the George Institute. And so I have this kind of lovely mix of doing the research, but also that management angle of bringing people together who are interested in women's health more generally.
A very interesting field of work, because I imagine there's a lot of people listening that, you know, wouldn't immediately think about those differences in like how diseases affect women as opposed to men. We think about it more broadly. What drew you to these issues?
So before joining the Women's Health Programme, I was definitely guilty of thinking about women's health through that very narrow lens of gynecological health, maternal health, sexual reproductive health. We call it bikini medicine, this idea that all female health is just restricted to where the bikini would cover. And I also was trained to treat sex in my analyses as a kind of nuisance confounder that needed to be adjusted away. And actually, it was only once I attended a talk by one of the researchers in the Global Women's Health Programme that it made me realise actually women's health is so much broader than periods and pregnancies. Yeah. And actually making sex and gender a central consideration in our work can reveal these nuances of health and disease that often we try and mask. I hadn't truly considered how the underrepresentation, kind of the pervasive underrepresentation of women across the health medical research pipeline, from animal studies all the way through to clinical trials, could have sort of these downstream kind of trickle-down effects of our understanding of human health. But when you actually stop to think about the fact that most diseases do not discriminate between the sexes, and yet so much of our understanding of health of health and disease is weighted towards the male physiology, the male experience, kind of the male default, it makes you question everything that we everything that you really come across.
Years to come, it will be you're at the beginning of something that's going to have a huge impact on women's health. Can you talk to us a little bit more about your work regarding gender-based risk factors for health issues and outcomes, and just go into a little bit more detail about that?
As I said, I currently have these two hats, and the first is actually doing sex and gender research. So kind of my work in that area can range from sort of looking at the representation of women in kidney disease clinical trials, all the way to quantifying and measuring sex differences, for example, in cardiovascular complications of COVID-19. In kind of our work around sex and gender, we're very careful to distinguish between sex as a biological phenomenon and gender as a social construct. And that's really, really key. And in fact, today I'm sort of switching between female and women and male and men, but actually they are two different concepts. One of the reasons why it's so important is that if differences are driven by sex versus gender, knowing that is really important in how we want to design future research or future interventions. It's going to be very different if the reasons for worse outcomes in women is because of unequal care versus because of some inherent, all men, but some inherent difference in how the disease manifests and progresses and in the sexes. I would say at the moment, especially in my research, I generally can use existing data sets, and it's a massive problem that people don't, that people who are collecting data don't distinguish between these two concepts. And it's really important to convey about sex and gender research is it's for the benefit of everyone, and it can reveal these nuances for both women and men, and hopefully when we get better at data collection, gender minorities as well.
Why do you think the health outcomes are so different depending on your gender, and what impact does this have on treatment as well for both men and women?
Most of the research at the moment comes from the cardiovascular disease space. What the evidence is showing is that females, for whatever reason, tend to have some sort of biological advantage. So we know that women live longer than men. Women and men are affected by different profiles of disease almost. So, autoimmune diseases are common in women and are more common in women than men, whereas cardiovascular diseases are more common in men than women. So there are kind of these sort of biological aspects. Women are healthier in general. If you think about the lifetime risk of cardiovascular disease, it's actually the same in men and women. And that could partly be explained by the fact that women live longer, but and also that that female advantage is diminished in postmenopausal women. So, again, when we're thinking about outcomes, it really depends on which outcome you're measuring in terms of whether it differences, in terms of whether it differs between men and women. There are going to be sex differences between females and males, but what is it about our healthcare systems, our health services, the way we treat women and men that actually causes women to lose some of that advantage? And I think that that's really problematic. So it might be the case that the risk is still higher in men, but what we should be thinking about is the risk higher in women than it needs to be?
And what you've found as well through your research, effect does that have on women that are in low and middle income countries?
Sex and gender research isn't very widely done in high income settings, but it's done to an even lesser extent in a more low resource setting. In order to do sex and gender research, you need data collected. You also need adequate numbers in order to be able to kind of divide the data up to look at health patterns in women and men separately. So I think it's a huge issue in low and middle income settings. When we're talking about women's health, we can't just be thinking within the health sector. We need to be thinking about education and access to opportunity and labour force participation and kind of economic empowerment, which I think there is better data around that into kind of from low and middle income settings, but how that translates into health outcomes for women that aren't just focused on that narrow view of maternal, sexual, kind of reproductive and gynecological health, I think is really missing.
What do you think are the next steps? What do you think that we need to do in order to improve health outcomes for women?
So representation is obviously incredibly important. Aside from representation, it's looking at the data for women and men separately. So doing sex and gender disaggregated analyses, being clear about when you're referring to sex-based factors versus gender-based factors. We've got a project going on at the moment. It's called the Message Project, which is being led by Dr. Kate Womersley and Professor Robin Norton from the George Institute. So they're working with funders, kind of major UK funders, to co-develop policies around the inclusion of women and gender minorities in health research and the importance of disaggregating analyses and data reporting by sex and gender. The reason why that sex and gender disaggregated analysis and reporting is so important is that if you think about the evidence base at large, it means that that data is out there. So it can be synthesized, it can be meta-analyzed, and then slowly, bit by bit, we can create this more comprehensive picture of health outcomes in women and health outcomes in men. It should be a starting point. It's not the end point. Of course, there are a huge number of other factors that need to be considered, and I'm in no way suggesting that they're less important. But I think if we can't get it right for sex and gender, then we've got no chance in hell to get it right for the other Absolutely. Important characteristics as well.
So Karina, you've talked about the importance of appropriate data collection in establishing concrete evidence in the different health outcomes for women. Can you talk to us a little bit more about this?
Yeah, so I think this goes back to my point about thinking carefully about what data we're collecting, but also how we're collecting that data. So I think a really nice example comes from the kidney disease space. The current understanding, based on existing data, is the prevalence of mild CKD, chronic kidney disease, is higher in women compared to men. Whereas when you progress to the more advanced stages of chronic kidney disease, which requires kidney replacement therapy of some form, so that's either dialysis or transplant, the prevalence is higher in men. But when you actually stop to think about where those numbers have come from, for later stages of kidney disease, they've come from dialysis registries. Now, who's going to feature in dialysis registries? It's going to be people that are receiving dialysis. There are questions around gender-based differences in access to care, or even preferences of care. And so, of course, we're going to have a higher prevalence of, or higher representation of men in dialysis registries, which is going to give us the impression that end-stage kidney disease or kidney failure is more prevalent in men. It's just a nice example of thinking about where does that data come from and how is it being collected and who's represented in that data set. I recently took part in a conference that was organised by KDIGO, which is the International Clinical Development Guideline Group for Kidney Disease, around women and kidney health. And one of the groups, so it's a conference of kind of centered around debate and discussion and identifying important knowledge gaps and one of the four groups was focused on sex and gender differences in chronic kidney disease. And so again, it was an amazing opportunity for me to meet other people working in sex and gender research, specifically in kidney disease. And so I'm really hopeful that, you know, off the back of that, we can build some international collaborations to move sex and gender research, specifically in kidney disease, forward, because it is lagging behind other fields such as cardiovascular disease.
So what projects have you got coming up this year? Like, what's going to be your main focus?
So my main focus, one is around coexistence of multiple long-term conditions with chronic kidney disease. So as I said, my area of focus is kidney disease. But as we know, you know, the issue of multimorbidity, i.e. coexistence of multiple long-term conditions in a single individual, is a huge issue at the moment. I'm working with a group of patients who are living with kidney disease and a host of other long-term conditions in the UK to co-design a project which matters to them. The group comprises me and 10 patients living with kidney disease, and we're working together to come up with a question that is relevant for them. Mm-hmm. And of course, bringing in that sex and gender component is going to be really important. Second is at Imperial College. So we're in the process of setting up a women's health research network, and it's really a network to bring together anyone and everyone who's interested in women's health across the college. And goal of the network is to broaden how we think about women's health. So whilst we do have researchers who are focused on sort of health during pregnancy and maternal health and those sorts of topics related to kind of traditional female health, there's a huge number of people who are interested in gender-based health equity. And so we're trying to engage with climate scientists and engineers and designers and all kind of a whole host of other people who are interested in gender-based health equity to create a network of people who want to advance improvements in women's health. Those are kind of my two main areas of focus this year. And if I can get those going, in collaboration with, of course, the team of people that I'm working with, that would be amazing.
It sounds so exciting. Also, I think you're going to have your hands full through this year, but cannot wait to see the outcomes. You'll have to keep us up to date so we can share across the Action for Global Health Network. I just want to say thank you so much for coming on the show and talking to us a bit more about your work. Where can listeners find out more information about the work that you're doing and where they can find you or your organisation?
Not at all. Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it. Best place to find me is probably on our Institute website. So that's www.georgeinstitute.org.uk. You can kind of navigate to the general email address and then find your way to me if you want to get in touch. I'm also on Twitter. My handle is @KarinaHockham. Happy to receive any messages through there as well.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Karina.
Thank you.
We'd like to say a big thank you to all of our wonderful guests who joined us today, and also to you, the listeners, for joining our very first episode of the Global Health Charity Radio Show. In our next episode later this month, we have Compassion UK, who will be hosting and talking more about their work fighting child poverty worldwide. See you next time.